This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is such a joy to be with Anthony Lewis, who has two Pulitzer Prizes for the coverage that he has done over many years for the New York Times, for books that he has written, for columns that we all know, and now Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Bill Russell.
The other thing, we talked a little bit about the blogosphere, and the limitations. There is an advantage that we have that was not available, that the general public has, that was not generally available in revolutionary times, or really until very recently, which is the internet. And the ability to access reliable, emphasize reliable, information, rather than just opinion. You can actually go back and find things. And the conversation we were just having about the power of the presidency forced me last night to go back and read the oath of office that the president takes. And it forced me to go back and read the oath of office that the Congress takes and that all government officials take. And in every case, the wording is different between the president and everybody else. But in all those cases, and I happen to have it here, if anybody's interested, but in every case, the oath, you swear or affirm that you will support, defend, and protect the Constitution. Not the church, not yourself, not even the approaches to Washington. The sole commitment of everyone who serves in the United States government is to protect the Constitution. And as you lay out the discussion about this one piece of the Constitution, the First Amendment, it also raises the broader issues, and particularly as it is manifest, the broader issues of our ability to critique the satisfactory execution of that oath, or the failure to exercise that, to be responsible to the Constitution, and this goes to the heart of whether we can govern ourselves, whether we can continue as a democracy, as a republic, as a political entity.
There's one fundamental thing about the United States that should be obvious, but it isn't always. It's a legalized society because from the beginning, the framers of the Constitution intended those who ruled us to abide by a set of laws, laws embraced in the Constitution, a set
of
rules.
Those who govern us, but don't rule us. Those who govern us.
Govern us, thank you.
I'm sorry, but Bill has taught me that that's a very important distinction.
It is. They're not rulers, they're governors. John Adams invented the phrase, a government of laws, not men. By which he meant it's not up to the whatever a man or a person in power wants to do. You have to obey the rules. And I personally have this notion, I suppose it's very simple-minded of me, that when the next president takes the oath of office, next January 20th, whoever it is, I don't care, Republican, Democrat, doesn't make a bit of difference, that the inauguration should say, once again, this is going to be a government of laws, not men. We're going to comply with the law. It's not going to be what I think is right or what I believe my power should be. We're going to obey the rules. I would love that. And I can imagine it coming from any of the present candidates, and I hope they will say it.
The present surviving candidates, which
yeah, the ones that are
which
now,
is a tribute to the democracy.
Yes.
You do quote Oliver Wendell Holmes, and I want to read it so that I don't get it incorrectly. The Constitution is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. That, for me, was back to your living, breathing, pulsing idea about the First Amendment. The idea that this isn't stuck somewhere in the 18th century. And it takes me to the people who currently are serving us on the Supreme Court, who are also subject to impeachment for all that it is a lifetime appointment, that it is an experiment and that we must continue to be actively involved in what that experiment is, what the elements are, and how we're going to move that forward. And it goes back to this is a government-based foundation on the law.
Let me just call attention to the phrase that you use of Holmes's to begin with. He was speaking actually not of the whole Constitution, but of the First Amendment concept of freedom for the thought that we hate, freedom for any thought, any opinion. And he said, that concept is an experiment as all life is an experiment now, just, I paused on it and repeated what you said because it's such an extraordinary sentence. Holmes was really a poet as well as a judge, and nobody else could have written that sentence. And the passage comes to an end as follows, more or less from my memory. While that experiment is part of our system, I think we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to suppress opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. Mm. How about that from Holmes? Mm. Fraught with death. We have to let all ideas flourish and all things clash in the open and not try to suppress things. We're always tempted to suppress those who don't agree with us. That's a temptation built into me and you and all of us. But we just have to grit our teeth and say, let it all hang out.
And when you say that of Holmes, Holmes of all people, death was not an abstraction to him.
Oh, how glad I am you said that. You know, Holmes wrote a great opinion on free speech in which he referred to war and said, I know that war is terrible. In 1929, when he was 88 years old, he knew that war was terrible because he'd fought in the Civil War. Think of it, 1929, the Civil War. He was wounded three times, gravely. His father, poet and doctor, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., the doctor, went down from Massachusetts to Virginia to treat him as a soldier. And when he died, a few years after the 1929 opinion, his friends found hanging in his clothes closet his Union Army uniform with the bullet wounds. Wow. Mm. He knew what it was about.
You stopped me for a moment.
I think you quote that. You don't say bullet holes in the,
no,
the
I
story
don't,
you tell. That makes it even more powerful.
I've learned it since I wrote the book.
Well, and it is in that same sense of learning as one goes forward. You do talk about tension. You talk about the tension between the First Amendment and the press, the First Amendment and individuals. And there are times that you say through the course of this eloquently written book that is... It's like reading a novel to read your biography of the First Amendment. How's this going to come out? Well, we don't know. Isn't that part of the beauty of what this is about?
You see, to me, the enforcement of the First Amendment by the courts over 60 years, starting in 1931, more than 60 years, but I mean mm-hmm. roughly, is a series of stories. Great thing about the American Constitution is it's not an abstraction. It's given flesh and blood. It's given meaning by the way courts deal with particular cases. Somebody comes along, carries a red flag down the street in California, and California, this is 1931, has a law that makes it a crime to carry a red flag down the street because it's a symbol of dissenting thought, dissenting ideas, and she's convicted. It's a woman carrying the flag, Yetta Stromberg. And the Supreme Court reverses that conviction. Well, it's a story. You want to know how it's going to come out. Is some woman going to go to prison because she carried a red flag? It's not an abstraction. It's a piece of reality.
As is the entire body of law of which you speak. Excuse me, Bill.
You quote somebody. You'll remember. I don't. Talking eloquently about how essential it is in this democracy and in the living nature of the Constitution that it be embodied in the people, that the courts are not sufficient to sustain that. We can't look to the courts. And then you say, yes, and, or that's not altogether true because the courts have been. And the lesson to me that I take out of that is this is a rich experiment that all the players have to be involved, otherwise things will fall off the track. That yes, the people have to, because the courts do pay attention to what the people think.
People have to be involved because the courts are just in their nature. Judges are not going to stray too far from what the public believes. The courts can lead, and they do lead, as Holmes and Brandeis, who began dissenting from repressive decisions in 1919 and dissented right through the 20s before the majority finally agreed with them in upholding free speech. They aroused public opinion on the side of free speech. So it's a two-way street. The courts... with their eloquence, judges with their eloquence, if they are eloquent, they're not always eloquent, mm-hmm. can inform public opinion, but the public can also provide the foundation for judges to build on in belief in freedom.
So we are not passive in what happens in
the
courts.
No.
Well, you say, in that context, you say over and over and over again something that we tend to forget, which is that in this, under this Constitution, it is the people that are sovereign. It's not the courts, it's not the king, it's not the president, it's not the Congress, it's not the bureaucracy, it's none of the above, that the people are sovereign, which means that the people have to behave responsibly, which is why the First Amendment is so important.
Yes, they have to know what's going on. How could they exercise their sovereignty if they're ignorant?
Indeed.
Well, of course, a lot of times they are ignorant, and people in power like to keep them ignorant. That's a tendency of people in power, regardless of party. We can do it faster, better, if we're not subject to criticism, but let's keep what we're doing secret. Then we can do it without a lot of bother of public opinion.
Well, we're not going to keep this secret. We are going to be back in just a moment. Forgive my interruption. For just a moment, we'll be right back with Anthony Lewis.